Many don't believe that either the trumpets with melodious noise or the infernal din await us where the road ends. But most, I fancy, have discovered that to be born is to be exposed to delights and miseries greater than imagination could have anticipated. That the choice of ways at any crossroads may be more important than we think, and that shortcuts may lead to very nasty places.
Hello and welcome to the Pilgrims Podcast. This is your host, the progeny Hannah Long.
And I'm the patriarch, Mr. Alan Long.
We've also got, as our host, Professor C.S. Lewis from Oxford. Hello to everybody.
We hope you've had a good week. And let me just say, before we get started, that I think Western civilization is better for having Matthew Perryman Jones on board.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds good.
I don't think anybody can lay a finger on him. Andrew Peterson might on a good day, but that's about it.
Okay, this has been your musical recommendation of the day.
We can cut that part out if you want.
Well, if we're going to start randomly recommending things, then everybody who's got Netflix needs to go and watch Broadchurch.
Yeah.
Because it's just...
But you definitely ought to go to Matthew Perryman Jones' website and get Land of the Living. It'll be the best $10 you've ever spent.
And that's the best TV show I've seen all year, so...
Happy holidays! Merry Christmas!
It's the
God
most...
God bless us, everyone!
Okay, well, the first item on our agenda is the most important, and it's the word archetype. We need to clear this up for those of you who have been
sore point.
People have been writing in rabid letters against
death threats.
Death threats. There have been. We had to call out some restraining orders. And the reason is that we have both been mispronouncing it over the last four podcasts.
Well, let's not go overboard.
But he was mispronouncing it more, so...
That's not true.
It is, too. Okay, well, the thing is, it's not archetype, and it's not even archetype.
I didn't say archetype.
You said archetype. I said archetype.
I said archetype.
You said archetype. Okay. You said archetype. Yeah. Okay. Well, now we're even getting farther than before. Okay. It is, in fact, archetype. You said archetype. I said archetype. It's archetype. Now that we've confused you more than ever, this is now the official policy of the Pilgrims Podcast, an ex cathedra announcement. It is archetype. Alright, so what movie are we talking about this week? Movies, I should say.
We're talking about Mr. Dickens' Christmas Carol, correct?
We are indeed.
And we're looking at the 1984 the authorized version, which is the George C. Scott, who was from Southwest Virginia. Southwest Virginia. There's a big distinction there.
Yes.
Not that I want to alienate all my California and West Virginia friends, which if I have like one. But you know, George C. Scott, that's the one we're primarily are most familiar with.
Yeah, we're also going to be talking about the Alistair Sim version, which is probably the most popular, most well known. We might drop in a few hints about the Muppets, because the Patriarch's a huge fan of the Muppets. And, of course, there's also the Patrick Stewart version.
That's not true. Half of the Pilgrims podcast might be.
Well, I have a feeling C.S. Lewis would have loved the Muppets. Well, I wanted to start out by... We're going to be talking about...
No, he wouldn't have.
It takes a little while for these Muppet statements to sink in. Okay, we're going to be talking about C.S. Lewis's contribution to that, or some of his thoughts on a Christmas Carol, and also G.K. Chesterton, because for once they actually had divergent opinions on something. To kind of start us off, I wanted to read from a piece by Stephen Greidanis, who is one of my favorite movie critics. And he said, "The attack on Christmas may be a hot story this year, but it's nothing new. Over 350 years ago, Christmas was forbidden in England by an act of Parliament under Cromwell's anti-Catholic Puritan party. Businesses were ordered to remain open, and even traditional Christmas fares such as plum pudding and mince pies were condemned as heathen. In Puritan New England, Christmas remained outlawed in Massachusetts until the second half of the 19th century." So...
because it was Christ Mass, right?
Yeah.
Christ Mass.
Yeah.
The mass part of that, I guess he took offense to.
You don't see many evangelicals out anymore saying, "Let's put the Mass back in Christmas."
That's true. Yeah.
Though I have seen that as a joke in various places. So, yeah. But Dickens, came around in the sort of early 1800s and decided that he wanted to write about Christmas. He wanted to kind of refresh the English tradition of Christmas. And he managed to do that pretty spectacularly. He was a really popular writer, and I'm not sure exactly how much influence he had in particular, or this book in particular had on it. But the kind of the Christmas vision that he had is something that is still very recognizable today. Chesterton particularly highlights the atmosphere that he creates of snow outside, fog, and
chestnuts roasting by an open fire.
That sort of thing. People kind of huddled around on the fire out on the street, going and buying things, and singing carols outside, going to dinners, spending time with your family.
Black Friday, going to Walmart.
Killing
Christmas cards.
Killing somebody over a TV.
Yeah. I'm sure he would have approved of all that.
Yeah, there's a scene in the book where he's talking about how great it is, you know, all these people out Christmas shopping, and I was thinking, man.
If you only knew.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
maybe you could have dialed that back a bit there, Chuck.
It's dog-eat-dog out there.
Can anyone here tell me what Christmas is all about?
Sure, Ebenezer. I'll tell you what it's about.
Okay.
Chesterton actually argues that the Christmas atmosphere is more important than Scrooge, or the ghosts either. In a sense, the background is more important than the figures. Would you agree with that?
Atmosphere?
Yeah, that Dickens creates, because he really does well with the atmosphere.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, the movies do that real well, but, you know, I mean, Dickens would have been writing in his contemporary deal. I mean, it would have been money houses, and it would have been, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't think he was probably aiming to create an atmosphere. I think he was trying to send a message.
Well, yes, but I mean, the sort of things he spends long paragraphs talking about the fog.
And I've read A Christmas Carol, but it's been a while since.
Yeah, I read it last week, so. And it's absolutely true that he creates a marvelous atmosphere. The very first, let me see if I can find it here. The first page talks about Marley being dead and so on, and kind of sets it all up. And then he really starts to kind of paint the picture of England in winter. The heaviest rain and snow and hail and sleet could boast of the advantage over Scrooge in only one respect. They often came down handsomely, and Scrooge never did. And he goes even farther later on. It was cold, bleak, biting weather, foggy withal, and he could hear the people in the court outside go wheezing up and down, beating their hands upon their breasts and stamping their feet upon the pavement stones to warm them. It really does a good job of creating an atmosphere. Now, Chesterton himself, I think he wasn't a huge fan of Scrooge as a character. Or, I mean, that he thinks that the way that Dickens paints him is not very accurate, because... It the kind of conversion story he wasn't a huge fan of.
Really?
Well, because he doesn't believe it. He thinks, and I meant to get to this at the end, he said, "There is a hardiness in his inhospitable sentiments that is akin to humor and therefore to humanity. He's only a crusty old bachelor and had, I strongly suspect, given away turkeys secretly all his life.
No, he did not.
So he thought that Scrooge in the book was quite funny, even at the beginning. So he thought, okay, this guy, he's too funny to really...
He was not funny. He was horrid.
Well, but he was horrid in a kind of endearing way. I think that's what he's getting at.
You've never worked for... Yeah, having worked... Well, I better not mention any names. But there are circumstances where that's the Scrooge characters can ring a little bit too true.
Well, I wanted that was the next point I wanted to bring up, which was just differences in portrayals.
We don't all work for Mr. Pennywig or Pennywhistle or Penny
Fezziwig.
Fezziwig.
Yeah. Well, I think he has a point in that the character in the book never seems to me quite as nasty as some of the portrayals, which I think, to their credit, they kind of make him a little bit more nasty, a little bit more miserable. Chesterton says that basically the whole thing is kind of wrapped up in the just the whole whimsy that is a Dickens book. So you can't really be miserable.
Which is a great name, Scrooge.
It is. It's a great name.
Ebenezer, which is rock, basically, right, from the Bible.
Yeah.
And Scrooge, which, I mean, we all know what Scrooge, the name Scrooge now is related to and where it comes from, but...
Here I raise mine, Ebenezer.
But Scrooge is just a great name for that character. It's a classic Dickens name.
Yeah, Gradgrind, Rogue Rider Hood. What's your favorite Dickens name? That's a totally random, out of the blue question.
Oh, Mr. Venus.
Mr. Venus. He's pretty great. Of course, there's also Eugene Rayburn, which is just fun to say.
Mortimer.
You ought to check out our mutual friend. Okay. Well, the differences in portrayals. We are most familiar with George C. Scott, as we've said. What were the major differences, did you think, between how he played the character and how Alistair Sim played the character?
That's a tough one. Why don't you answer that?
It's a matter of nuance in some ways that kind of builds to a larger impression. Alistair Sim struck me as in the beginning, as a very miserable person, somebody who is mean to people, but he's the sort of kind of threadbare and thin and dingy and scrawny type person that obviously doesn't have any joy in life. And he's also much more quick to change, in a way. And I think he's actually closer to the book in the way that he portrays the character. Because in the book, each ghost, a lot of the stories kind of end with a moral of the story moment when Scrooge says, you know, he's looking at the little boy that he used to be. And he says, and the spirit says, what are you thinking about? And he says, I just remember a little boy that I kicked on the way home for singing a Christmas carol. I wish I could be back and be nice to him. And later, when he sees himself as a clerk, I wish I could talk to my clerk now, you know. And so he's a little bit more quick to express regret. Now, George C. Scott...
holds out to the end.
Yeah, and I like that much better because I think that it feels less episodic. It's much more effective. But also,
it's a moment of redemption.
Also, he is a very self-satisfied Scrooge. He is going to sit back and have a good hearty laugh about how clever he is. He is kind of a pudgy and stocky Scrooge who's very successful. Who is obviously taking a little bit of kind of priggish joy in his own accomplishments, and that sort of self-satisfied arrogance I find very appealing. He's very sarcastic. He's very funny, even in the beginning. So I really like how he brings out a little bit of the humor in the character, even throughout the story. Those are kind of the big impressions I had of him.
Well, they both did real well.
They were both very good, and I liked the fact that they were different, so that I wasn't comparing them so much as contrasting them. I could say, okay, this is really good for what it is. It's like two really good versions of Hamlet.
Well, in the Scott version, I think I kind of felt like, you almost felt like there was a good guy hidden underneath there all along, for some way. I guess I would say it that way. Is it the other fella, what's his name?
Alistair Sim.
Yes, Mr. Sim. So, with him, he seemed to me to be a lot nastier, or that he seemed a lot darker.
Well, yeah, and I thought that he that was...
With Scott, it was meanness and burly, but there was... I could buy into that he had lost his goodness, that he had lost his way. The other fella just seemed like he had always been mean or bad, you know. Or dark.
Well, there was something kind of more pathetic about him,
yeah.
I think.
That's a good word.
And that's why I thought that I didn't find him so much meaner, because they were both mean.
Pathetic's a better word.
But he seemed like someone who just had never had cracked a smile in his life, you know. Someone who was very sad.
Yeah.
Scott was very arrogant. He was, you know, very confident in the way he was handling himself. And he kind of treats the whole ordeal as if it's a well-meaning self-help book. It's just like, okay, yeah, I've learned my lesson. That's very good. I'll apply it. And, you know, even up until the second spirit, at the end of it, he says, okay, I've learned your lesson. I will change. I'll go home and try and be a better person and do my seven ways to become a better businessman, you know, tithe a certain amount of on Sundays and that sort of thing. Yeah, anyway, that's kind of what I was thinking of with him. The character of Scrooge himself is several times in the book described as a man of the worldly mind, someone who is very worldly.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I guess you'd associate that with business. I mean, he was kind of an international trader, it seemed like, you know. I mean, he probably dealt with people from all over the world and in some respects. So, yeah, I'd buy that.
Yeah, it does several things with that. He's not only worldly in the sense of mammon, you know. He's very materialistic. He believes in being a good businessman. But he's also kind of a little bit of a secular materialist, in that he doesn't... I'm not trying not to use the word atheist, but you know, someone who doesn't believe in boogeymen or spirits.
Well, he's a very practical man. His security is in his wallet. His security is in what he can accomplish and what he can control. And he's built up these walls around him of security that are, you know, reinforced with money, which he has a lot of, and he's sacrificed everything else for that security. And although, yeah, I mean, it's a, you know, the ghosts and the spirits aren't real, but they are, I think, the representative of ways that, no matter who you are, you build up these walls around you and you try to insulate yourself from the world and from the forces of compassion and of goodwill and peace. And yeah, I mean, he uses the ghosts because it's convenient. It makes it a nice compact story and lots of that stuff. But everyone has those, I believe, everyone has those walls challenged and breached eventually. I mean, you know, whether it's health that decays, or families that are destroyed, or marriages that fall apart, or any number of things can bring those tragedies to bear. And
yeah, and you realize how very little money can do for you in the end.
That's right. And his idol that he set up is just really...
Yeah, and I really like the little details about how, Dickens does this a little bit, the Scott version does this really well, is that he doesn't see himself, he is not the bad guy. He doesn't see himself as the bad guy. He sees himself as someone who is practical.
Yes.
And that anyone who is trying to force him to be otherwise is
should be boiled in their own pudding.
Yes, buried with a stake of holly in their heart. And that these people are idealists who don't know about the real world, and that they're just being kind of ridiculous.
They are, yep.
I mean, he says, he tells them...
Christmas is a poor excuse to pick a man's pocket once a year.
Yeah, and he sees himself as someone very reasonable. In the book, he's talking to Belle, who's his girlfriend, and she is kind of getting on to him for loving money more than he loves her. And he says, what idol has displaced you? And she says, a golden one. And he says, this is the even-handed dealing of the world. There is nothing on which it is so hard as poverty, and there is nothing it professes to condemn with such severity as the pursuit of wealth. You fear the world too much, she answered gently. All your other hopes have merged into the hope of being beyond the chance of its sordid reproach. I have seen your nobler aspirations fall off one by one until the master passion gain engrosses you. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of feeling like that's part of his security, but it also feels like he's trying to prop himself up as someone who is successful in the eyes of the world. He really cares about how he's perceived.
Do you think so?
Well, in a way. I mean, he's living in his own world, and he feels that he is the most successful person there, that he is living by his own creed.
Well, I think he cares what other people think. I think he's, again, he just sees himself as a very practical man, and that if you don't want to be practical, you don't have to be, but when, you know, he's worked hard to make his living, he's worked hard to make his security, he's earned it. That it's by no, you know, it's by no, it's by no grace and by no effort on anyone else's part that he's done this. Well, doesn't he say at one point, you know, about that? I know in the movie he says something about, you know, that I think it's when he's talking to Belle and he says something along the lines that, you know, that I've secured I have a secure position, or, you know, my financial position is secure.
And that's something that's kind of really important to us, I guess, or makes a whole lot of sense, that entire worldview, because it's something that kind of our ancestors have held as somewhat of a guiding principle, is the idea of security.
Through
wealth and...
And it's not so much through wealth as it is just this whole idea of that my security comes from my actions or what I have done. Now you can carry that in many different directions. You can say, well, you know, I'm going to have a pantry full of dried food, and I'm going to have 500 gallons of water, and I'm going to have 400 cases of ammunition, and, you know, that's my security. Or you can say my security is in gold, and I'm not going to, you know, invest in the stock market. Or you can, or there's people that say I'm going to invest in the stock market. There's people that say that, you know, they have land around them. They want to own their property. They want to own their land so that they're secure. And all of those things, I think, have a ring of truth to them. But we're all just a breath away, or a, you know, just anything can happen that will break through all of those secure barriers and just break you down, and they will break your heart, and they'll challenge your very foundations.
And then somebody will turn up and steal your bed curtains.
Yes, and then all you're left with is faith. And so many people, I think, at that point are just... they really struggle with it because they've never had to rely on that before. And that includes me in many respects. I'm not saying I'm not, but...
I mean, the thing about all these things is that they're all good things, you know, to have to have a good job, to have a bunch of ammunition in your cellar. It's great. But it's like, again, it's like Tim Keller says, when you make good things into ultimate things, you have a big problem because you can lose good things.
And that's what Scrooge is. What's happened to Scrooge?
And when, later on, when we kind of talk about that conversion from that into something else, I want to kind of mention the fact that, again, with Scott, after the second ghost, he still hasn't changed. He's just kind of decided, okay, I'll go back and I'll you know, be a little bit more charitable. I'll do what's right, you know. But in the end, what has to change him is a change of heart, something that is beyond his control and that just completely shakes him to the foundation of his being, something that's very emotional. It hadn't touched his heart yet. It had just touched his reason. But all of this kind of draws in a little bit of kind of a political, economic side of it. Traditionally, it's a story that's seen as being more critical of libertarianism, of somebody who's very isolated and who's hoarding their money and trying to make money and grinding the faces of the poor, etc., etc. But it's also, I think, kind of critical of liberalism, or at least of a big government way of charity, in its way of dealing with charity, because Scrooge not only hoards his money and apparently doesn't even use it to take care of himself, he's that much of a miser, but he also, when those gentlemen come by and try to get his charity, he says, are there no workhouses? Are there no prisons? You know, my taxes support those institutions, and I think that should be enough. And his idea, he has no idea of an obligation to do anything beyond support community things, that he doesn't really have to put his pound of flesh in that game. And I think that a lot of liberal charity and a lot of modern American charity in general is like that, in that we want the government to take care of people. We don't want to have to help take care of people ourselves. We want, you know, sure, raise my taxes a little bit, as long as I don't actually have to go out and touch those sorts of people, as long as I don't have to deal with it myself. So I think there's kind of a coldness in government charity. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, when Marley shows up to him, it's the best line in the whole thing. He says, "Business," cried the ghost, being Marley. "Business," cried the ghost, wringing his hands again. "Mankind was my business. The common welfare was my business. Charity, mercy, forbearance, and benevolence were all my business. The dealings of my trade were but a drop of water in the comprehensive ocean of my business." And that's really what, to me, the whole thing's about, is that you have I have a responsibility, that we have a responsibility for our brothers and sisters of mankind around us, whether they're Christian or not, to show compassion and to be forgiving and to show the love of Christ to them regardless. And I can no more retreat from that responsibility any more than I can hand that responsibility to someone else. So that's just what I believe. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the ultimate solution that Dickens presents is, if he was more liberal, he would have had Scrooge quit being a businessman and probably move and live in a commune where they grow flowers and
sing
anti-war songs.
Well, I'm sure that would have been a foreign, concept to them.
Well, possibly, yeah, but he was also critical of libertarianism, which was all about gain, so there's not really an Adam Smith thing in here either, but what we kind of end up with is somebody who sees it as their own individual responsibility to help the poor.
And joyfully.
Yes.
Not grudgingly, but to joyfully do that. And that's where Scrooge finally gets to. I mean, his heart is broken for those that Tiny Tim is a very important character in this thing, because he, at least in the movie, you know, he walks by him the first time and basically says, you know, "Get off the corner, you you urchin. And that's important because voyeuristically, or whatever you want to call it, he gets to observe Tiny Tim's heart and his relationship with his father and how important that is to them, and you know how very precious and fragile it is, how fragile Tiny Tim's existence is.
Yeah, and Tiny Tim is somebody who's living on the edge of death all the time.
Yes. And
he's the utter opposite of Scrooge.
Yeah, and has just complete joy in his life, even though he's crippled and he's likely to die and his family is rather destitute.
And he has nothing.
Yeah. He has nothing, and yet he has everything. He has complete joy. Scrooge, on the other hand, has everything and no joy at all. And so
early on, in a frankly much more religious time, the Victorians that received the book, they pretty much the general impression of it was that it was an allegory about the nativity, and that the Cratchits and Tiny Tim represented the Christ family. That Tiny Tim was a Christ figure.
So she made a good pudding.
She made a really good pudding. It was divine.
Another triumph, my dear.
Yep. It was. Boy, was this immaculately conceived. Okay, yeah. What do you think about that? I mean, because now it's kind of seen as a more, not so much irreligious, it's just not particularly religious at all.
I mean, I don't know if that's what he meant, but I don't see that personally. Because, just because I don't.
I mean, that had never occurred to me.
Yeah.
C.S. Lewis, he used to say that Dickens's story was had a marked absence of any interest in the incarnation. Mary, the Magi, and the angels are replaced by spirits of his own invention, and the animals present are not the ox and the ass in the stable, but the goose and the turkey in the poulterer's shop. So he kind of took that even more extremely, and thought that it was kind of a really secular tale that's giving you a tale of
I could see Christians having somewhat of a problem with the whole thing, you know.
Yeah, the ghosts are a little bit of an issue.
Yeah, and I mean, I could see that, but and you know, and I know that Mr. Dickens had his issues too, right?
Yes.
But
that whole Ellen Ternan thing.
If you're going to throw that out, then you have to throw out It's a Wonderful Life. You have to throw out.
Lewis would have.
And a lot, even the Chronicles of Narnia, right? I mean, who have, because they're using very secular or, you know, I'm going to struggle for the right word, secular or unusual methods to convey these moral stories, moral ideas have Christian underpinnings.
Yeah, and I disagree with Professor Lewis on this one.
He's not going to be happy about that.
Yep.
It won't do.
Okay, well, I'm sorry. Yeah, I disagree.
Bah
humbug. Well, I disagree with him on this point because, and I think he's actually being inconsistent, not only because of the Chronicles of Narnia, but because both he and Tolkien, who was a good friend of his, felt like if you were going to tell a story about Christianity, you need a way that's not strictly allegorical, in which you can use other images or other archetypes to convey a story about spirituality or truth. And I would have liked a little bit more theological clarity, possibly, but I think that in the end he gets at something that's very truthful, something that's really basic about the world, about how to interact with the world. And I think that while the ghosts could have been better represented more representative of traditional Christmas themes, they do a fairly good job of representing the important things.
I mean, you know, in today we would say, well, we're going to have a time machine that takes him back, and we're going to have you know, that takes him into the future and stuff or something. Well, that's no different. I mean, Mr. Dickens used his imagination to try to force Scrooge to relive his life and to contemplate his future. That's all that he's really doing, and he's used it in the form of these spirits, you know.
Yeah,
which you could almost say are angels. I mean, I'm not saying angels.
Yeah.
But he could have made that stretch. He could have probably used that instead, and everybody would have said, "Oh, angels, that's okay," you know.
Yeah, I don't think that. I think it's more of a plot device than anything.
Sure.
A way to get him around.
Yeah.
In a way, I mean.
In a terrific way. I mean, that you know, Christmas present. He has 1,900 brothers or whatever.
Yeah, 1,800
brothers.
That's so great.
That's a great line. I mean.
And then Scrooge's reaction is so in character. He's like, that must be such a large family to provide for.
Yeah. And
right back to money with him. He's all about the security of that sort of family.
But it's a great idea. It's a great concept.
Incidentally, I think that the ghosts in the George C. Scott version are much more personable than the ones in the Sim version. That I have much more of an impression of them. Though, I would say that the first ghost in Scott's version looks like a female version of David Bowie.
No,
I mean, it was the 80s.
Terrific.
She looks like something from that Jim Henson movie,
no,
The Labyrinth.
She does not.
She does, too. That haircut, gosh. The Christmas present, definitely Scott. He's awesome. He's an 8-foot-tall guy with a big laugh. He's great.
The Enforcer.
I would give the 1951 version an edge on the spirit yet to come.
I would.
Because there's less Nazgul shrieking.
Well, it's rather poor special effects on their part there.
Yeah.
You know.
Both of them are dated in their way.
Yeah.
The 50s version has
it's not bad, though.
Really brassy music that comes in at the wrong times and kind of sentimentalizes, if that's a word, everything. Now, the George C. Scott version has music, it has better music,
yeah.
but it's still too all-pervasive. I wish they'd kind of toned it down a little bit more at times. I tend to think in general that a lot of movies distract from what's actually going on with the characters by putting music there.
Yeah, they've got great music in that one.
Yeah, it's better music. Particularly the theme song, which was written for the movie, God Bless Us Everyone. It's really great. You ought to look up the lyrics on that. It's a wonderful little song, and it's actually more religious than the movie in some ways.
And it fits so well.
It does. Yeah.
Well, you know, but there are some, you know, yeah, could it have been more Christian? But there are some references to Christian thought in that thing, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, there's Tiny Tim says. You know, I hope that everyone will remember the...
Looks upon me and will remember...
Who it was.
Who it was that made the lame to walk and the blind to see.
Yeah. Yeah, and Dickens was... He really liked Jesus as a person. I don't think he... Dickens was not somebody who was really enthusiastic about a harder doctrine or theology or anything. He wasn't interested in getting into the intellectual aspect. But he liked the vague ideas of Jesus as someone who's very charitable, who loved the poor. He wrote a book about it.
And that may be true, and I'm really speaking from ignorance on this, but I think it speaks to the power of Christ that even when he's mentioned, even when he's brought into a story like this in a kind of an oblique way, that the power of the gospel and of what he, you know, the changing hearts and minds is a very powerful idea, and it speaks to the power of Christ in that. I mean, it's really a shame. I know a lot of the movies, the Christian movies today, just seem to be so, don't really get that. I think they just don't really get that. Now, I will say, with the exception of the church that puts those, the
Kindred Brothers,
the flywheel. And even Fireproof, because they were behind that too.
Yeah, they did that. They did. Courageous.
They seem to get it a lot better. Yeah, you can talk about the acting and the production and all that, but they get that message much stronger, and it comes through much better than in more high caliber, quote unquote, Christian movies. because, hey, Charlie Brown, that, you know, when you get down to it, this is what Christmas is really about.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I have my issues with those movies, but I think they do a really good job of teaching fairly simple moral lessons about what it means to live as a Christian.
And how lives can change. I mean, they do a pretty good job of that.
Yeah, and sometimes it's sappy and inspirational.
And sometimes
but
I'm just throwing that up. What I mean is by that is that they get that message when it's really grasped and when it's really allowed to kind of go into full flower. It really resonates with people, and that's why Christmas Carol is so great.
Yeah, I think that. You know, even if it's not specifically a Christian story, though it was for many years perceived to be one, and that the ending conversion was actually a conversion to Christianity, it has that feel to it. And I like it because, like most of Dickens, it has darkness, it has some real darkness there, so it feels like there's some real risk. There's a real danger. The poor are not living in clean little tenements, though I think that the Cratchits in the Scott version are a little bit on the clean side. I like the other ones a little better because they seem more down to earth. But
more realistic.
Yeah, more realistic. The other ones they seem like they could have just easily have played the royal family, and they might have Susanna York. But in the end, what do you think Scrooge's change consists of? What would you list as kind of the major causes? Wait a minute. Before you go to that, I wanted to highlight one difference that I noticed between the way the two movies handled the conversion scene in the graveyard, which in the Sim version it starts out they're pretty much identical, but Sim ends by grasping the spirit's robes and saying, "I'm a changed man. I'm a changed man. I will change," you know, and that's when it morphs back into his bedroom. George C. Scott ends by saying, "Spare me, spare me, spare me." Neither of those lines were in the book. The book ended with him saying he would change. "I will honor a Christmas in my heart." I think I like the Scott version better in that it gives the supernatural person or host. I really like the fact that in the Scott version, the choice or the salvific power is given more to the supernatural than it is to the person who is changing. Sim says, "I have changed," and therefore it's kind of more of a moralistic tale. Scott says, "Will you spare me? Will you forgive me? Will you do this? Will you do this?" And I really like and again, this is kind of a theological point, I guess regeneration precedes change.
Yeah, well,
I mean,
that's a whole big problem. But here in the book he says, "Spirit," he cried, tight clutching at his robe, "hear me. I'm not the man I was. I will not be the man I must have been but for this intercourse. Why show me this if I am past all hope?" For the first time, the hand appeared to shake. "Good spirit," he pursued, as down upon the ground he fell before it, "your nature intercedes for me and pities me. Assure me that I yet may change these shadows that you have shown me by an altered life." The kind hand trembled. I guess that's the ghost hand.
Yes.
"I will honor Christmas in my heart and try to keep it all the year. I will live in the past, the present, and the future. The spirits of all three shall strive within me. I will not shut out the lessons that they teach. Oh, tell me that I may sponge away the writing on the stone." And that's not exactly a Christian. He's not exactly at the altar, you know, accepting Christ, is he? But he's. But it's a. And it's, so I guess you're right. It's a very moralistic thing. But it's a good start. I mean, and it's one of those things where, again, the underpinnings of that is Christianity, the compassion and the unwillingness to have idols is all Christian ideas, and that, you know, one thinks that. One believes then that on the next Sunday he would have been in church.
Yeah, According to Great Annas, in the Patrick Stewart version, it ends with him going to church.
Oh, really?
Trying to sing God Rest You Merry Gentlemen and getting the words wrong.
I might have to get that version.
Yeah, I want to see it because Richard E. Grant is in it, and he's the best Pimpernel.
What does he play? Cratchit?
He plays Cratchit, yeah. Which is a little bit of a wild idea to imagine him in that role. But again, I really like that there's that little nuance there in the book. It's more moralistic. In Sims' version, it's definitely that. They emphasize the fact that he has changed and that he's planning to change. George C. Scott, that's really kind of the first deep emotional outburst that he has had, and he feels despair. He knows he has seen his sin etched into this gravestone, and it's a...
Well, the wages of that.
It's the wages of that, the death that is awaiting him, and he begs for mercy.
Yeah.
And that's why I really like that contrast, and even if it was invented from the book. So, you know, there you go, Mr. Dickens, you've been one-upped. But there was one more thing I wanted to kind of mention about that, and I wanted to talk about how, just the changes in him, what things he gains. He starts out by being a miserable character, he finds joy. He also ends up by becoming more like a child, which is something that I noticed in the book as being kind of emphasized. For instance, it talks about when he's visiting the Cratchits that the little boy Peter is reading from the book. This is after Tiny Tim has died, and the verse that Peter is reading is, "And he took a child and set him in the midst of them." And that's from one of the Gospels, and it's talking about how Jesus, right after that, said, if you must
enter the kingdom of heaven,
then you must become like a child. And he also, I can't find the verse now in the book, but he also is talking about Fred and Fred's wife, and they're hosting a party. And they play a really silly game in it where people are chasing each other around the room. And Dickens makes the point, he says, they were acting just like children, but, you know, sometimes it's good to act like children. Sometimes it, and of course then you have the symbol of Tiny Tim. Scrooge, by the end of it, feels as merry as a schoolboy, and he's acting very silly indeed, and he loses any sense of propriety, and even in the last chapter, it's talking about how he changes, and it said, some people laughed to see the alteration in him, but he let them laugh, and little heeded them, for he was wise enough to know that nothing ever happened on this globe for good, at which some people did not have their fill of laughter in the outset. And knowing that such as these would be blind anyway, he thought it quite as well that they should wrinkle up their eyes in grins, as have the malady and less attractive forms. His own heart laughed, and that was quite enough for him.
Amen. And I think that's a very good point, is that, I love it at the end where he's up on, you know, the Scott version, he's up on the bed and he just collapses back, which is exactly what a child would do.
And I really love it in the Sim version where he decides he must stand on his head. That's adorable.
That's a good point.
I mean, it's so hard for me to choose between the two, even though Scott has the edge of nostalgia, because I've watched it growing up, but Sim is, he's just, they're both really infectious.
That's true.
Joy is just infectious.
Yeah.
And I really like that the scene where he talks to his maid or housekeeper, and she thinks he's insane.
Yeah. They both get it really well. They really do well. And you got to feel for them. They probably shot that last. And they've had to be this, you know, cold, callous guy all the way through, and they can finally let go.
Well, that's kind of like George C. Scott's entire career, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
It's like Mr. Patton getting saved.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I really liked that not only is it a tale about becoming a moral person, but it is a tale about becoming a humble person, somebody who is childlike and who doesn't care about how they look in the eyes of the world, you know.
Right, anymore. That's gone.
Doesn't care anymore. Right?
Those are finally broken. Those are finally broken through.
Yeah. Yeah. And
yeah, long for that day.
Yeah, and Dickens was really good at that. He really enjoyed having characters that, and almost all of his characters have something whimsical, something laughable about them. None of his characters are real grown-ups, in a way. Which I think is
Fezziwig
wonderful.
Fezziwig was especially, I mean, that was a great character. I don't remember in the book how much he has, but...
He was kind of a foil to Scrooge in that he showed what Scrooge could have been.
Yeah, it should have been.
Yeah, and even, and one of the things I really appreciate about Dickens...
Dave's like a monkey.
...is that he doesn't, unlike many modern philanthropists, take the poor and make this book about the people instead of people. You know, you hear
instead of person.
Revolutionary. Yeah, yeah. You hear revolutionaries talking about the people as this sort of huge mass of humanity, but he really personifies humanity. He has it in Tiny Tim, or to quote from Chesterton, he says, Dickens did not pity the people, or even champion the people, or even merely love the people. In this matter, he was the people. He utters the secret anger of the humble. He says what the uneducated only think, or even only feel, about the educated. And in nothing is he so genuinely such a voice as in this fact of his fiercest mood being reserved for methods that are counted scientific and progressive. He talks about the surplus population and kind of these really cruel government people coming in and trying to put people into workhouses where they'd be split up, and it's all for their own good and that sort of thing. Dickens, instead, goes into a little family's home and sees them joking with one another and playing practical jokes on one another and being human beings. And I wish even that he had done that with some of the undeserving poor, people who have some more rough edges, but he really has a love for humanity. Dickens loves people. He doesn't love humankind, he loves people. He loves the people on the street that he sees every day. And I think that's really important because abstract charity can be very cruel.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's what we tend to have in the U.S. anymore, is kind of an abstract charity. Another thing Chesterton says in his introduction to A Christmas Carol is that Scrooge is a really modern man. He belongs not only to the hard times of the middle of the 19th century, but to the harder times of the beginning of the 20th century, the yet harder times in which we live. Many amiable sociologists will say, as he said, let them die and decrease the surplus population. The improved proposal is that they should die before they are born. It is notable also that Dickens gives the right reply, and that with a deadly directness worthy of a much older and more subtle controversialist. The answer to anyone who talks about the surplus population is to ask him whether he is the surplus population, or if he is not, how he knows he is not. That is the answer which the spirit of Christmas gives to Scrooge.
Yep, very good.
Yeah, and we were in sociology the other day, kind of talking about this, and the specter this time was overpopulation, which we talked about last week. Literally, like the next few days, we started talking about how the world was going to be overpopulated, and the sky would fall, and the world would end, the earth would drown in a sea of pollution, that sort of thing. And I was just sitting there back there going, oh my gosh, have any of you read Mark Steyn? This is not going to happen. We spent a little time talking about that, but the idea was that we need to industrialize the rest of the world, because in industrialized nations, people stop having children because they don't need them, like they need them on a farm or something to work a farm. So they'll stop having children, have more like one or two children, and that's a good thing because there will be less population. There was just something about that felt really wrong to me, that we kind of forbid people from having children. It just feels so paternalistic. I don't know. I mean, even our charity anymore feels like it's we are saving the planet by giving you money and food and help and industrializing your nation so that you will stop having children. There's just something kind of cruel about that. I don't know.
Well, I'm becoming, and I may have said this on the last, so I don't remember, but I'm becoming a fan. I'm very anti-big government. But I'm also becoming more anti-big corporation, and in some respects anti-industrial, because those things, both of them, tend to break communities, so that from a technology standpoint, I may have 300 friends on Facebook, but I talk on a weekly basis to like one or two of them at most, physically, either on a phone or on a meeting or an acquaintance, whatever. And that's not a good thing. I just don't think that's a good thing. And so, 100 years ago, we would have had a very close community. We live in a very rural area. We would have had a very close community because we had to. We would have had children because we had to have children. I mean, it's as an economic thing as much as a joy, which it is a joy to have children. Even Hannah. But all those things have changed, and I don't necessarily think they've changed for the better. I mean, I'm not against government. I like government. I like order, and I like
government as it's intended to be.
But I like local government. The localer, the better. And
And the less it interferes with people, the better, you know. Another thing, and I've quoted Chesterton all day today, but he was kind of an authority on Dickens, was he talked about how Scrooge was in many ways kinder than a lot of our social reformers today. He said Scrooge, at least he had a kind of live and let live way of viewing the world, even if it was more like die and let die. But he wouldn't have pursued Rob Cratchit to his own home to spy on him, steal his turkey, and run away with his punch bowl. He wouldn't have written a law that forbade these things. He would have just left people alone. He wasn't. He would have regarded that as theft to forbid things or to try and infringe on people's liberties. So at least there was that.
It's a great story. It's a wonderful story, and I will try to see the Patrick Stewart version sometime soon.
Yeah, and I'd like to.
And if anyone is reading this and has other recommendations,
make it so.
Listening to this, you please make other recommendations on A Christmas Carol.
Yeah, yeah, it would.
Everybody has an opinion on A Christmas Carol. We have a friend, a family that we know that friends of ours that they read the entire book every Christmas Day. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. It's
three
kind
or four
of
4 hours and read it.
Yeah.
That's a pretty dang good tradition. I like that a lot. I think that's a good idea. I don't think I'll be doing it because I'm usually exhausted from cooking on we'll see.
All right. Well, ratings, everybody. It's that time.
Oh, dear.
Okay. Well, I'm going to say that the George C. Scott version is 4.5 stars with half star knocked off for some of the kind of cheesy 80s stuff going on. The spirit of Christmas Yet to Come has kind of an E.T. finger that he waves out and screeches like a black rider, and it's a little bit cheesy.
Yeah.
The Alistair Sim version, probably 4 stars, which is, again, a pretty good rating for me. I felt the music was distracting. Sometimes the narrative suffered from a little bit. They invented quite a bit, actually, and went off the trail into Scrooge's business adventures. I don't particularly see why. It felt like a narrative that was less spare and economical. So that would be my ratings. But they're both very enjoyable, some really good performances.
Now, I think I'd be in the same ballpark for both of those because they're both so well done. And, you know, when you sit down to watch either one, but in particular for us, the Scott version, you know, why do you keep rewatching it? And that's something that I know a lot of people don't do, but that's something we can do in our house, is we can watch and rewatch excellent movies over and over again just because they're excellent movies and the acting's so great and the writing is so great and the production's so great and the stories are great. So
yeah, I mean, how many times have we seen Pride and Prejudice?
I don't know.
It's infinite.
I haven't watched it at any, but I've been in the room a lot when other people are watching it.
Okay, my mother's watched it at least 30 times. I can't say much. In the year and a half since I've seen Broadchurch, I've seen it 3 times. Last episode, 4 times. I really enjoyed it. Anyway, you ought to watch that, people. Okay, well, I guess that's it for this week. What are we going to watch next week?
I don't know. Next week's Christmas.
Is it?
Right. The week of Christmas.
Well, we'll be recording next Friday, Saturday, Sunday, which will be the
week before Christmas.
So
Christmas is on Thursday, so Christmas Day.
Yeah. Well,
I don't know. We could do. Do you want to do another Christmas version?
Well, we ought to do another Christmas movie. It is the season. We've already done two. Three, actually. These two Christmas movies and Children of Men.
It's not a Christmas movie.
It's Christmassy.
No, it's not.
Okay. We could do a Charlie Brown Christmas, but I don't think I could talk about that for an hour.
Oh, yeah.
I couldn't.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. We could talk about Christmas, Charlie Brown Christmas and... Yeah, we could talk about that for an hour. Because you could talk about Charlie Brown for an hour, easy.
Well, you just... By the way, the Patriarch just wrote a piece on Charlie Brown over at his blog, What's He That Wishes So. You need to go check it out. It's great.
Thank you.
Yeah. And, yeah. Okay, well, why don't we do It's a Wonderful Life? I think we could talk about that for a while, even though we're pretty much going to talk about the same things as A Christmas Carol.
Okay.
All right. That's it for this week. You can leave us your thoughts, opinions, comments, anything you disagree with us about, recommendations for topics or movies we should watch at thepilgrimspodcast@gmail.com. Find us at our blog at longview95.blogspot.com, on Facebook or on Twitter as Longish and Grove Boy. So,
and go out and download that Matthew Perryman Jones album.
Watch Broadchurch.
Just do it. Just do it.
Land of the Living.
Land of the Living.
It is a pretty wonderful, wonderful album.
It is epic. So thanks to Andrew Peterson for posting about that years ago.
Yes, when Western civilization crumbles around our ears, and when the aliens are shifting through the rubble, one CD will rise from the ashes, and it will be Land of the Living.
And on that note,
God bless us, everyone.
Bye-bye.